I am David Polk, Program Director of WFMT. While the classical music scene in Chicago doesn't really slow down during the summer, with all the various festivals happening and well underway, the main cultural season just ended a few weeks ago. And it was another very busy season for classical music in Chicago. In 2015 and 16, we saw a new president at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association take over, a world premiere at Lyric Opera of Chicago, a reopened theater downtown, and smaller organizations experienced both great successes and unfortunate conclusions. To help take stock of the previous season, we invited John von Rhein to the studio to talk about all of that and more. Von Rhein has been the classical music critic for the Chicago Tribune for almost 40 years. John von Rhein, welcome back to WFMT.
Thank you.
The Chicago Symphony Orchestra just finished their most recent season, and it's hard to say that we're at the end of the cultural season because, of course, we're so busy right now with Grant Park and Ravinia and whatnot. But why don't we start with the traditional, I should say, cultural season, and take a look back at how our various classical organizations did, and perhaps we could start as generally as possible. So how's classical music in Chicago doing?
Well, classical music in Chicago is thriving. I will say, you know, there are some problem areas and there are areas that could be better. But I think overall, if you look in the national perspective, Chicago is healthy. We always need more money, the big organizations particularly. But it's been an interesting year. Few changes, few groups went under. Couple of groups are coming up.
Well, since CSO ended more recently, why don't we start with the CSO? Mm-hmm. What are some of the most important events that you think happened this season at the Chicago Symphony?
Well, I think for me and for most regular CSO goers, the main event had to be Mutti's Falstaff concert version. I mean, that was the most anticipated event and probably the most artistically rich of all the CSO programs. Perhaps not a surprise, the world's leading Verdi conductor, leading a really fantastic cast and orchestra and chorus. Exceedingly painstakingly well prepared. That was a highlight of the Mutti weeks. We lost Mutti, of course, because in his entire February residency, because he was recuperating from hip surgery right after the Asian tour. So that made the spring residency and the summer residency more, I think, anticipated. Season began with finally a settlement of a contract, a new 3-year labor agreement between the CSO Association and the players. So
went right up to the deadline, didn't it?
It went actually past the deadline because the players played a free concert at Millennium Park without a contract, and then they settled. And so a sigh of relief there. Other highlights for me, we've had some strong guest conductors this season. I think of Gennady Rozhdestvensky, Susanna Milkey. Always good to have Esa-Pekka Salonen back. Bernard Haitink, our senior eminence, along with the about-to-be 75-year-old Riccardo Muti. So we're not doing badly at all in terms of both guest conductors and soloists and what the music director is giving us. In terms of repertoire, I don't think this season was terribly well balanced. I'm on record in the Tribune as writing about that. Next season looks to be more adventuresome, better balanced, a few more world premieres. I mean, we had one world premiere this season, which is hardly enough for a major American orchestra.
Right, that's been a common theme of yours in your column going back years.
Oh, yeah. Not just the season, yeah.
Is always pushing for new music, for music that's outside the normal repertory.
Well, I think, if the Chicago Symphony can't use its accumulated history and clout and prestige to get behind living composers, who can? It's terribly important that this orchestra set a certain example for other orchestras. And when I see what New York, Boston, Philadelphia, and a number of the middle-tier American orchestras are doing in terms of new music, I think we really need to be out there and waving the CSO banner on behalf of living composers. But on the other hand, we do have a thriving contemporary series, the Adjunct Music Now, with two new composers in residence. Samuel Adams, who had a new piece performed this past season, and Elizabeth O'Gonick, who we have yet to hear from. So in that realm, contemporary chamber music is doing rather well. One thing I was unhappy to see about looking back at things we've lost this past season was the CSO's dropping their Beyond the Score series, Jared McBurney's multimedia adjunct. I mean, that sort of plugs in with my contention that the CSO needs to be doing more things around the normal subscription series. And Beyond the Score sort of was one example of that. It was a way to get at the classical music experience through a different way, with visual illustrations, with actors, with this or that. And I thought it mostly was wonderful. And to have it dropped ostensibly because it wasn't producing new audiences, and I dispute that.
That we should clarify, that was the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association's reason, was that while it was selling tickets, it wasn't selling tickets to new audiences, and it was very expensive to produce.
Well, that may have been a problem of marketing. Throw their marketing muscle behind getting the word out. But it was an example of the orchestra doing something beyond its normal purview, and sort of analogous to Lyric Unlimited in that respect.
Now, if I can play devil's advocate for a moment, if you're the administrator of a large classical organization, or let's say of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and you're under pressure from your board and for the bottom line to fill seats, you know, this is the typical new music argument that you and I are very used to, but perhaps those not as involved are used to hearing. The LA Phil has a larger budget, and the Boston Symphony has a larger endowment.
And a huge population base in the case of LA.
Right. So what does one do? You need to fill seats. A lot of people are just detracted by it when they see a new piece of music on the program.
Well, I don't think it's such a problem. Look, this is an age-old argument. It's a question of balance in the programming. It's not that you have to shove new music down the throats of reluctant subscribers, but give them a choice. One week may be more weighted toward the standard repertoire. Other weeks could be a little bit more adventuresome. I just think the balance has tipped a little bit too much toward the safe and conservative realm. Now, mind you, of course, Jeff Alexander, president of the CSO Association, yes, as you say, he has a very difficult multiple constituency to deal with. He's got cost-conscious trustees, absolutely, who probably would like Muti to keep going, doing Brahms cycles and Beethoven cycles ad infinitum. On the other hand, as an executive director, he has to look toward not only the orchestra's present well-being, but its future constituency at a time when classical music is buffeted by so many social and demographic forces. We've got the standard graying audience. We've got younger people fleeing concert halls to other forms of entertainment, mostly online entertainment, I suppose. How are you going to pull those people in? Well, I don't know if pulling them in by more Brahms and Beethoven and Schubert, as wonderful as that repertoire is necessarily the way to go. But the larger picture is, what about formatting? Pierre Boulez tried to open up the New York Philharmonic's standard concert format, but with his rug concerts in the 1970s. I'm not saying that concept would necessarily fly at Orchestra Hall. This is not a very adaptable hall. But things like that, format changes, different ways of presenting the art form, I think would start attracting a younger crowd and perhaps tap into funding sources that the orchestra may not be getting the full benefit of now.
Maybe they'll learn something from the Budapest Festival Orchestra, which is coming and has been known for doing midnight concerts.
Or I think learning something from what lyric opera is doing, and that's a whole separate topic. Because since Anthony Freud arrived as general director, lyric has been going out in all sorts of experimental directions, trying to innovate, trying to get what is probably the most conservative of classical music art forms off its duff and attract new public, new funding sources. So we have everything from Renee Fleming's Chicago Voices program, mariachi opera in Pilsen, the American Musical Theater Initiative postseason. We just had King and I the year before. Carousel pulled in very good crowds. And the year before, 58% of the audience had never been in an opera house before,
right,
in our opera house before. So something is going on there, and I just wish the CSO would be as adventuresome as Anthony Freud's lyric is in terms of, let's try this. It may not always work, but let's see and see if it'll fly.
You interviewed CSO music director Ricardo Muti this spring. And I paraphrase, but he said something along the lines of new music not speaking to today's audiences. And this caused a lot of, at least on social media that I could see, so much backlash. What did you make of all that? Were you surprised by this?
I wasn't really surprised. I mean, Maestro Muti is who he is. He comes out of a different background from an Alan Gilbert at the New York Philharmonic or a Yannick Nézet-Séguin at the Philadelphia Orchestra. I got a lot of feedback, too, from people saying, how could the maestro say this? If the music director of a major orchestra perhaps is not willing to go too far in that direction, well, make it the business of the guest conductors to do so. I mean, in years past, we've had rather adventuresome guest conductors who seem to have a reasonably free hand to do what they wanted in terms of repertoire. For instance, I mentioned a conductor I'm very impressed with, Susanna Mielke, the Finnish conductor. She's all over the world right now and doing great things. Well, her new music repertoire is incredible. Why don't we get more of that? Yes, it was nice to hear her do Scheherazade this year, but a lot of conductors do Scheherazade. The late Pierre Boulez was an example of an in-house conductor who did his repertoire and was allowed to do his repertoire. We haven't had that kind of expansion into the 20th and 21st century repertoire since Pierre stopped coming here a couple of years before his death last January, and that's too bad.
You mentioned Jeff Alexander, I think we could still call him new, president of president of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra Association. And in December, right before he arrived, you wrote in your column, or maybe he had just arrived, a new regime at the CSO has yet to articulate, at least in public, clear goals and bold strategies for building audiences, freshening the presentation of standard symphonic repertory and positioning a hidebound institution to confront the challenges faced by classical music in the early 21st century. So it sounds like from what you just said, you're still not convinced that that has happened.
Well, the CSO is like a huge ocean liner. To try to get it to turn around is a major course correction. No, I stand by every word of what I wrote in the Tribune, and I don't see it happening anytime real soon. I think we can begin to implement some of that. I hope they would, because the orchestra is in such fantastic shape artistically now. They love Muti. Muti loves them. So I'm not worried about any decline in standards. What I am worried about is that the orchestra kind of sinks back into a safe, conservative, rather hidebound routine that perhaps doesn't address the role of the symphony orchestra in America in the early 21st century. I think Chicago audiences are ready for more. We certainly see in the growth of local contemporary ensembles an appetite for the new. We see an appetite for new old music with our period ensembles like Haymarket Opera, like Calipigian Players, music of the Baroque. So it's, I don't think audiences need to be challenged. Yes, you need to reassure audiences with safe doses of the familiar, but as I come back to my original point about it's a question of balance, and I would like to see that. I keep coming back to the lyric model, but they are really trying to, yes, do the standard eight opera season up to a high international level, but then around it to have all these ancillary activities that get lyric out in the community in ways it hadn't been before, when it kind of sat back on its haunches and said, well, you come to us. Well, I think the CSO needs to do more of that, that people still have this stereotyped image of that you have to dress up in tuxedos and fancy gowns to go to CSO concerts, that Orchestra Hall is this kind of ivory tower, citadel of high culture that they couldn't possibly relate to. Well, this is nonsense. Muti has tried by taking the orchestra to the South Side and to Millennium Park for these free community concerts. There need to be more of those. He believes also in the CSO as a potential instrument for greater community good in terms of benefit concerts. For instance, the most recent concert by the so-called Chicago Symphony Musicians at the Studebaker Theater, which raised about $50,000, I think.
This was an event where the musicians and Maestro Muti volunteered their time.
Well, the musicians formed a not-for-profit independent group. This is very important to stress. Had nothing to do with their function as the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. But Muti, who believes in such causes, agreed to conduct without fee. The players agreed to conduct gratis. Studebaker gave up its space for free, and it was a worthwhile activity. Now there seem to be problems with the concept. It may not fly in future. I'd rather not go into it right now until we know more details. All I want to say is that this is a way for the musicians, and they recognize this, of reaching out, of doing something they wouldn't be able to do as the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And it's not like they're in isolation. Other bands of symphony orchestra musicians in this country have done benefit concerts and fundraisers like this. So all I can say is if it's quashed right now, that would be rather unfortunate. And I don't think Maestro Muti would also be very pleased with cessation of activities that way.
And we should mention also, for those who don't know, the Studebaker Theater is the newly renovated, newly reopened theater in the Fine Arts Building downtown on Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, I mean, this is first this hall. It goes back to practically the time of the founding of the CSO, but the management of Fine Arts Building has taken it over, has gutted it. Well, not totally gutted it, but refurbished it. And it's going to be what could be a very interesting small hall, and it's centrally located, very close to Orchestra Hall on Michigan Avenue. Chicago Opera Theater is going to do two of its shows next season there, and which should be a good size for a company of that scope, which doesn't need a big orchestra and doesn't do big works requiring big forces.
Incidentally, my understanding is that WFMT's very first live remote broadcast happened from the Studebaker Theater with the Fine Arts Quartet.
Oh, yes.
We have the recording somewhere in the back. So important to the station's history as well.
Maybe the station will broadcast other chamber events from there.
Indeed.
Who knows? And the other hall that I'm very excited about is this brand new Galvin Hall at the Ryan Fine Arts Building of Northwestern University. A marvelous chamber hall, gorgeous views of the lake beyond. What I've heard there so far is very promising, excellent acoustics, and more and more groups seem to be interested in using it. And, of course, it'll be a wonderful hall for faculty and student groups.
I'm David Polk. My conversation with John Von Rhein, classical music critic of the Chicago Tribune, will continue in just a moment. When we come back, Von Rhein will share his thoughts on Lyric Opera of Chicago's experimental Lyric Unlimited program, tell us about a couple of not-to-miss concerts at the Grand Park Music Festival and at Ravinia, and reflect upon how the changing media business has impacted music criticism. Why don't we dive a little bit into more detail with Lyric Opera of Chicago? You touched upon it a little bit ago.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, you seem to be very interested in what Anthony Freud, the general director of Lyric, is doing with all these commissions. And a lot of these are done under the wing called Lyric Unlimited. Can you describe what Lyric Unlimited is?
Well, we should be clear, and commissions are works like Bel Canto, mm-hmm. and the works for the mariachi operas were commissions. Lyric Unlimited is, in broadest terms, the community and education outreach wing of Lyric, and Cayenne Harris is a wonderful, dynamic executive director of that program, and lots of ideas and lots of support from the administration of Anthony Freud to execute those ideas. So I've been, yes, very interested in what they're about. So far, I think they're batting very high. I can't think of any conspicuous failures, but at least the point is that they're trying things.
What's been the most interesting initiative of the past year, season, I should say, in your opinion?
Oh, several of them. A very talented young American composer, Matthew O'Coin, had a Lyric Unlimited premiere here called Second Nature, which they did with Chamber Forces at Lincoln Park Zoo. Talk about branching out onto unusual opera venues. Not ideal, perhaps, but look, they were trying. But it certainly was a site-specific work that was appropriate since it's about an ecological theme, and here it was at the zoo. So that worked. I liked the last two mariachi operas. I mean, there's not works for the ages, but the point of those was to bring in a new audience, and they did that. I saw completely different crowds at the Opera House, really getting into it. It was their music, after all. And they were having a great time. They went crazy afterwards. And I thought, wow.
Something different
isn't
for everybody.
That nice? Right. I mean, opera goers, let's face it, they tend to sit on their hands and they're not thrown out of their seats by anything. So that's fine. And I mean, we had a world premiere at Lyric. We had Bel Canto, which I think was done at a very high international level. Jimmy Lopez, the composer, is very talented, going on to some great things. I liked his score very much. I like Nilo Cruz's libretto. I did have some problems with the work, but those problems related to the source material, the Ann Patchett novel, which dramatically, I think, would have defeated just about the most brilliant creative team. But the important thing is Lyric did it. It should be doing more world premieres, more commissioned works. We have to enlarge the repertoire. San Francisco Opera does, Houston Grand Opera, which Anthony used to head, has been at the vanguard of commissioning new operas. So let's have more of these things at Lyric, and let's have more of the ancillary activities through Lyric Unlimited.
And it did unexpectedly well, I think.
It did quite well.
In terms of ticket sales, Bel Canto.
It did very well in terms of ticket sales. It attracted a national press, and it attracted PBS. They got funding for a PBS telecast, has yet to air.
That will for sure air on WTTW sometime this fall. I don't think we have a date yet. And this was also, wasn't this also Anthony Freud's first full season that he planned himself?
Yes.
General directors and their administrations, they have to plan many years in advance.
It's really now 3 to 5 years, more like five. Yeah, and so there was all kinds of interesting bellwethers in this season, Anthony's first season, about what Lyric's future will be. The highlight really for me of that season, and for many of us, was the Vatsek, the new production of Vatsek, which was really extraordinary. We had a delightful Cenerentola. Barbara Gaines came over from Chicago Shakespeare Theater to do a rather fun, frisky Marriage of Figaro. We had a good Rosenkavalier. Always nice to have Richard Strauss back at the house. And a very good Nabucco as well. So that was an example of a good balance of a season. This coming season, we will have our first, at long last, staging here in Chicago of Berlioz's Les Troyens, the Trojans. So, and the start of a new Ring cycle, which was high on Anthony Freud's list of must-dos when he came to Chicago.
Was that already announced 2 years ago?
Yeah, it was already announced.
Time flies.
Well, his input was already being felt, yeah. Well, he had just launched a ring of his own, really, at Houston Grand Opera. So it was kind of a fortuitous conjunction there.
So we've had two complete seasons now that we know about, programmed by Anthony Freud, or at least with Anthony Freud at the helm of Lyric. Is it too early to sense any trends about his interests, about which direction he's taking?
It might be a little early. I would hate to put any words in his mouth. You would have to talk to him on the microphone. But so far, it seems like he and his music director, don't forget, Andrew Davis, who has been here a lot longer, has great influence and great ideas about casting, about other conductors, about creative teams, and certainly about repertoire that we need. I know Sir Andrew has wanted to do Troyens for decades here and finally got around to doing it, finally was able to do it. It was on the books, about 15 years ago, and then that was during an economic downturn in the national arts economy and the national economy, and they took it off the books. So here it is. And so I look forward to that very much, as I'm looking forward to the new David Pountney ring.
Now, Lyric Opera of Chicago, in fact, I think it's in their mission statement, has always been very proud of the fact that they always run in the black, or at least try to, and succeed most of the time. This past year, they announced some financial results that were that revealed declining revenues. I think a lot of that may have had to do with investment income. And
a lot of that was the result of just a terrible year for the market in general, and the CSO felt that pinch too. Some of their investment results didn't pay off. They balanced the books. They did not turn up a deficit, unlike the CSO, which has run deficits for the last, about 5 years. $1.3 million, I believe, was the figure for the last fiscal year. So, yeah, it was decidedly a mixed financial report.
Should we read anything into that? And also the fact that there's no longer a report issued at the end of the fiscal year. Is there anything? Do you think there's anything to be worried about there?
I don't really think so. Look, I think there's a danger in looking at any one season. You have to look over, a five-year span, and then maybe some trends could emerge. But this, we don't know what this last fiscal year will be yet. They probably won't announce the results till this fall. But I'm not terribly worried. Look, Lyric, like CSO, has very deep pockets. They're still compared to the Met, which is in very dire shape in terms of spiraling costs, which Peter Gelb just doesn't seem to be able to get under control. Antony Freud runs a very taut ship. And yes, one year might be more disappointing than others, but I'm not so worried about Lyric Opera. They've got a crackerjack board. They have a terrific development department. They have really a lot of goodwill from the corporate and foundation community behind them. I'm more concerned about the middle groups that don't have big budgets, can't afford to take out ads in the newspapers, don't have any of these financial crutches that the big boys depend on. I mean, we've seen at least one middle-sized Chicago group go under this year, Baroque Band, which was too bad. The group, which used to be a resident ensemble at WFMT, did good work. And then over the last couple of years, artistically and leadership-wise, they kind of faltered. And one big nail in the coffin was that they lost their entire core of players to Haymarket Opera, which ironically played a very successful Callisto the same weekend that Baroque Band announced it was going under following the departure of the artistic director.
A successful new production in a larger theater as well, right?
Yeah, in a larger theater, in the Athenaeum Theater, which they're going back to this fall for another show. I hear, though, that it's wonderful Jewel Box Little Theater main stage in Rogers Park. It will be no more as of this coming season. So they're going to have to look for another shoebox, tiny shoebox venue.
No more to performing groups, but I think it will still be available for rentals for private events.
Is that what you hear?
Is my understanding. Weddings and such.
I hadn't heard that. Okay, weddings and such.
We'll see. We'll see what happens.
We will see. But in any case, I would hate for them to lead a nomadic existence.
Right. Well, you spend a lot of time covering the medium and small sized groups in Chicago. We have so many.
Yeah.
Can you just give us a couple that we should be paying closer attention to over the next season or so?
Well, I'm outspoken about getting behind new music, as you know, as our conversation indicates. We're doing so well. I mean, we have the established groups like Contempo down at the U of C. We have Fulcrum Point New Music Project, Steve Burns' group that's been around for a while. The brash newcomers, like relative newcomers, I should say, Spectral Quartet does a lot of interesting contemporary string quartet repertoire. Ensemble Dal Niente is worth everybody's attention. They're innovative, they're daring, they're in your face. Third Coast Percussion is another group that I like a lot. The ICE group, International Contemporary Ensemble, is partly based here, partly on the East Coast. Also worth paying attention to. And, I forgot 8th Blackbird, probably the most dynamic of all. I don't want to compare groups. I mean, they're all worthy of a city like Chicago, of our sophistication and audience interest. But 8th Blackbird, as you know, just completed a year's residency at the MCA and did very well at it. There was a lot of interaction with the regular museum public. There were commissioned works. There were open rehearsals.
And you wrote that you noticed a lot of people that you don't normally see at concerts. Where do you think those people came from?
Well, I didn't poll each and every one of them, but, the regular museum crowd that may have been not so predisposed to new music, but was because of what 8th Blackbird
was doing.
I mean, it was where they live anyway, so it did not involve any great, sea change in terms of their mobility.
Now, I want to spend just a little bit looking at the summer, since this is airing in the middle of the summer, one big sea change has been at Ravinia. Now, the CSO season there has not begun yet, but the big change is that there's no longer a music director for the for the summer season of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. What do you make of that? How did it end up turning out?
Well, some of that you'll have to ask Wells Kaufman, the executive director of Ravinia, who has taken on a sort of de facto music director role there. Well, I don't know. We have to wait and see. This is the first time in, what is it, 50 years since the Ravinia has not had a music director. Conlon and Eschenbach before him, and of course Jimmy Levine before him, all put their mark on the programming. All were worthy landlords of the CSO in the summer months. So I don't know. We're getting some new guest conductors this summer. We'll see how they pan out. But a guest conductor can only do so much. He or she comes in and they have a couple of days rehearsal. They do one performance of one program up there, unlike Grand Park that at least repeats a program over a weekend. So what can you do in terms of broader nurturing of summer classical music at Ravinia?
Well, does a summer home where they perform for 6 weeks, does it need that broader nurturing if you have a music director downtown for the rest of the season?
Yeah, I think it does. Levine was a perfect example of that. He carried the orchestra into artistic directions that Schulte was either unwilling or unable to do. There are lots of things that a festival like Ravinia can be doing that are not possible downtown. So I think a music director is very, very important. Look, Hollywood Bowl has its music director, who is also the winter music director, Gustavo Dudamel. The Boston Symphony's music director, currently Andres Nelsons, is also the music director of Tanglewood. Now, admittedly, commercially, Tanglewood and Hollywood Bowl and Ravinia are all rather different beasts. Ravinia has moved more in the direction of popular music programming, I would say, over these last 5 years at least. There's certainly a lot of chamber music still to uphold the classical tradition. But no, I would like to see a young, energetic American music director at Ravinia who, like Levine, would put his or her stamp on the festival and really carry it in some interesting new directions. Yes, they can do all the movie nights and all the pop nights and everything else that assures a commercial festival's bottom line. But that is not to say that we should not have some classical expansion. Look, Ravinia has a proud tradition. Stravinsky, Copland, Walton, they all conducted their music there back when. Yes, it was a different era. Okay, we're not living in the past. But that's not to say we can't have this kind of excitement, this kind of pushing of the envelope again.
Well, you must be counting down the days, speaking of Levine, to when he conducts back at Ravinia on July 23rd.
This is going to be an event.
How many years was it since the last time?
It's been
decades.
Oh, it's been about 25 years since Jimmy conducted the CSO up there. So we knock on wood that health-wise he'll be fine, because remember, he's also guest conducting the CSO downtown in November, I think it is. And so I know the players and the chorus are all looking forward to that. But I was going to say, not to use Grand Park as a cudgel against Ravinia, although I have in the past and continue to, but there's an example of what an enlightened music director can do with symphonic programming. I mean, just this last week, we had a rarity that you'd have to look far and wide in America to ever hear. The Epic of Gilgamesh, this big oratorio of Bohuslav Martinu. I mean, would you see that at Ravinia? No, I don't think so. But it's the sort of thing a festival like Grant Park that isn't beholden to the box office can do, and do rather well.
Well, but isn't that the very thing, though? They're not selling tickets.
Right. They're not selling tickets. So it's kind of like comparing apples and oranges. But that's not to say that Ravinia can't do certainly they can't use limited rehearsal time as an excuse, because Kalmar is the ultimate in preparing difficult programs in a sliver of rehearsal time. But I look to Grant Park for that kind of repertoire innovation, and they do standard repertoire too, but they have interesting young soloists who wouldn't ordinarily appear or get the chance to appear. Ravinia does some of that too, but as I said, they are doing something in that realm with guest conductors this year to fill the Conlon breach.
And I should clarify also, while I said that the Chicago Symphony Ravinia season has not started yet, the classical chamber season has very much started and is ongoing. So you can check out the schedule there. Grant Park, what are a couple of performances that are still to come that we shouldn't miss?
Well,
so we don't miss the next Gilgamesh.
Well, speaking of choral repertoire, we have two choral events, big and small. The small is Christopher Bell's wonderfully well-trained chorus. They're just a wonderful group. They're doing a couple of a cappella programs in community centers, Columbus Park Refectory and the Southside Cultural Center. Looking forward to that. And then the biggie will be at the very end of the season. Kalmar is coming back to lead the orchestra and chorus and soloists in the Damnation of Faust of Berlioz. So those are high on my list. I'm also looking forward to returns of people like Christoph König, Austrian conductor who had a success last year and is coming back and doing Bruckner again. And a couple of new ones, Michal Nestorowicz, I believe that's how he pronounces his name, a young Polish conductor. Heard good things about him. He's making his Grant Park debut. So Grant Park is out there trying things. And yes, they don't have to worry about ticket sales, but they still have to fill those reserved seating areas, and they are charging for those, so it isn't absolutely free. But the public seems to have settled into that reality that there's no free lunch. And this orchestra has costs. And in order to do music at this level, somebody has to pay for it. And the city can only do so much, given how financially strapped it is.
It is quite an experience to go to Grant Park and see thousands and thousands of people there, often to hear a work that none of us have ever heard before.
Yeah, how many
or at least live.
How many thousands turn out for Martinu in a normal concert hall situation? Yeah, exactly. No, it that always cheers me no end to see. And you think, well, of those thousands, maybe a fraction might be tempted to come back and actually buy a ticket to Orchestra Hall or somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's certainly no excuse in Chicago to not be able to not go to a classical concert.
Well, yeah.
Especially since you don't have to pay for it.
That's right.
You've been at the Chicago Tribune for 40 years.
Almost 40 years.
In September.
September of 2017.
In 2017. Okay.
Right.
So it's coming up soon.
It's coming up.
Early congratulations.
Thank you very much.
On that. As we all know, especially over the past several years, we're all adjusting to this new economy of media, especially newspapers. How has this impacted criticism over the last several years?
Oh, boy. Well, it's a good question. How many hours do we have? Well, it's a whole new digital journalistic universe. Really, we now at the Tribune are basically a digital platform that also produces a newspaper. And having said that, it means that we report on news round the clock, and it's getting it into the paper, or getting it online, I should say. See, I fall back into the old, the old ways of thinking. It has impacted a lot on criticism. More instant criticism is probably being spurred on by digital demands. People aren't reading the print version. And I don't know if the classical music audience, which has a sort of median age of 50 to 55, is so digitally savvy. Maybe in other areas of the country and world they are, to make that leap of faith. I know a lot of readers who follow me regularly still say, oh, I picked up the paper this morning and you weren't in it. And I said, well, you've got to stop thinking about picking up the paper. Right. You've got to go online and get your smartphone open to the Digital Tribune. We're an e-newspaper now, as any self-respecting major paper news organization in this country pretty much has to be. One thing, obviously, that has happened in my nearly 40 years here is there were four daily newspapers when I started in 1977. Now we are the only major news outlet in town that covers classical music on a regular day-to-day basis.
Right, the Sun-Times stopped reviewing the Chicago Symphony, I think it was a year and a half ago.
Well, they haven't.
On a regular basis, I should say.
Yeah, well, Hedy Weiss, their theater critic, does review Muti, and she does review Lyric Opera. But they don't have the kind of scrutiny that the Tribune gives to the classical music life. And I think that's very unfortunate, not just with the Sun-Times, but in general, that we don't have more critical voices sort of sparring and getting opinions out there. We had, when I came here, it was a really interesting mix of critical temperament and styles. And you as a reader could sort of align yourself with this or that voice and say, well, that other one doesn't know what he's talking about and you do, or things like that. Now we don't have that. We don't have competing voices in many markets, not just Chicago. I would like to think maybe, you know, glass half full, that digitally there are possibilities now of covering the art form in ways that aren't even imagined yet. I don't know what those might be. I'm kind of an old fogey of criticism now, but I'm certainly willing in my time here to explore those. My editors are very supportive, but they are putting out a digital product. Obviously, they want more hits. And there are pressures to
create. Has that changed how you review or how you cover or the angles? No.
No, no. I write the way I've always written. I mean, my standards are the same. The great thing now is that I have more space. Before, I tended to feel rather constricted about being able to expand a particular point of view on a particular piece or a particular artist. Now I don't have to worry about that. It's maybe there's some times when you have a little bit less than you would like, but generally I'm very pleased. It's a very supportive management environment at the Tribune, and my hats are off to everybody right now. It wasn't always thus, I have to say, but it certainly is now, and It's a real pleasure, and I hope to continue doing what I do. I enjoy it, and I enjoy the feedback of the musical community and the groups.
Well, John von Ryn, we could go on and on. We've barely scratched the surface here, and we haven't even gotten into the upcoming season yet. But perhaps we'll do that another time. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Well, thank you for having me, David. I appreciate it.
John von Ryn is the classical music critic at the Chicago Tribune. To listen to this conversation again and to continue the conversation, join us at WFMT.com. Michael Sangabino recorded and edited our conversation. I'm David Polk, program director of WFMT.